Do you or someone you know experience persistent and unrelenting feelings of depression? Perhaps they disappear for a short time, but then they return, sometimes within days, weeks if you're lucky. Despite your best efforts, medication, psychotherapy treatments have proven ineffective in alleviating your struggle. If so, there may be more at play than meets the eye. In my field, this is often identified as narcissistic deflation, a facet common among those dealing with narcissism. Is it really depression, or is it narcissistic deflation? That's the question I'm encouraging you to consider today. Without the expertise of a therapist trained to work with personality disorders, narcissistic deflation oftentimes goes undetected. I've observed in my practice that individuals facing repeated, unsuccessful treatment approaches sometimes realize through our collaborative efforts that their struggles are due to shame. We call this a shame state. And a shame state can lead to a narcissistic deflation. Okay, so now you may be asking, what causes or what leads one to enter into this shame state? Let me answer that by way of giving a few common examples. Picture this. Consider a case of a patient presenting symptoms of recurrent depressive episodes, and he comes in to my office exhibiting all the signs of a typical depression. He's taking a triple cocktail that's three different types of anti-depression medication, and they don't seem to shake these feelings. So in one particular session, he arrives stating that he's entered into a depressive state. Now, he describes in great detail all the typical symptoms that typically go along with depression. But as I try to slow him down and begin to reconstruct his past week, in other words, what is it that led up to this shift in his state and his feelings? Now, initially, this is typically met with, I don't know, or nothing has changed. I just woke up one day and I wasn't feeling good, or I felt depressed. But if we keep after this, exploration typically reveals that there's some trigger. In this case, what we began to discover was his partner was traveling for a trip, a work trip out of town. Initially, he was anticipating continued communication through text messages. He was surprised and disheartened when his partner did not respond throughout the entire weekend. These kinds of scenarios are not uncommon, such as a woman expressing depression. Same situation, she comes in complaining of feeling depressed, but upon very close exploration, we begin to see that she was very disappointed when her husband, at the last minute, needed to cancel plans for a date night because of some work obligation. These instances often point to what's referred to in my field, that's the field of psychoanalysis, as a shame state. And yes, you're hearing this correctly. What I'm suggesting is that at times, a state of shame is misinterpreted as depression, leading to misguided treatment. The shame often goes unnoticed, but is typically seen when there's a heightened state of excitement that's coupled with a disappointing response. The fellow, for instance, excited about ongoing communication with his partner, is met with a blank screen. He says something like, "My phone went dry." There are no text messages, no response. And the woman, the same thing. Looking forward to a date night with her husband, suddenly she's confronted with an absence. Let me say this another way, with another example. Can you try to picture a scenario where a woman, bursting with enthusiasm and positive news about something that happened during the day, returns home excited to share her experience, but receives a lackluster response from a loved one? In both of these situations, these individuals have never learned how to master shame and humiliation. So they will get triggered, and this will cause a sudden shock-induced deflation of narcissistic affect. You are now thrust into a hypo-aroused affective state, which you struggle to auto-regulate. Now, I say hypoaroused, you see, and that's what's commonly confused with depression. So you go from a state of hyperarousal, excitement, looking forward to something, anticipating something positive. Then there's a shock, a surprise, and you move into a hypoaroused state. Now, wait a minute. Let's say that this is really about shame. Shame, which leads to a narcissistic deflation. You may be asking, what causes this? Where does this come from, right? Why am I, or someone I know, vulnerable in this sort of way? Now, I'm going to respond to this question with my own bias. My bias as a psychoanalyst, so I'm going to turn to what I think is the most comprehensive theory of early childhood development. This is psychoanalytic theory. And this is one particular theory. This is what we call in my field an object relations model. But let me just give an example of this, okay? Can you picture that the most important figure in our formative years is our primary caregiver? Now, during a very early stage in development, the child has reached the highest point of his narcissism. In other words, there's just an overestimation of his powers. This is a phase of increased independence and autonomy-seeking behaviors from the child. They may engage, for instance, in activities such as exploring their surroundings, testing boundaries, and asserting their own emerging sense of self. However, it's very important for me to note, at the same time, the child continues to rely on their caregiver for support, guidance, and reassurance as they navigate this new stage of development, this new stage of autonomy. So for the caregiver, this time in development entails providing a balance of encouragement and support for the child's growing autonomy while also remaining available and responsive to their needs. So caregivers play a crucial role in fostering, and here's the key, the child's sense of security and confidence as they venture out to explore the world around them. When things go well, there's a foundation that develops for healthy emotional development. That's what gets laid down in this early stage of development. Let me try to be more specific now in terms of what this might look like. Picture this in your mind. A child who bravely is exploring a boundary with a caregiver or is exploring a new territory at the local playground. The highly aroused, excited child is exploring his surroundings, and it's at the moment of reunion, returning, right? He returns to the caregiver in an elated state, in a state of excited expectation. And this is the moment that he's reconnecting with the caregiver, but he's very excited because he's exploring the park in his own autonomy. And this is like an amazing experience for the toddler, not even a toddler, but the developing child, let's say. Let me dwell on that for a moment because that's an important point. Because what I'm referring to as the child or the toddler, but I want you to keep in mind that these states, and this is really the critical piece, these are states of excitation and then reunion with a loved one, but that they start, that's what I'm suggesting, is they start in early childhood, but they continue throughout life. So you can imagine this in any number of different scenarios in your own mind. This could be a latency age child or a young teenager. They can have a very exciting time out with friends and they lose track, let's say, of time and they arrive home late for dinner or they stay out past curfew. See, I'm just mentioning this because we're looking for the cause. Like, why is somebody vulnerable to these shame states? And what I want to just really emphasize is it's not just the child. Like, it starts there. But this continues through development. Or let me just keep going to give you some other examples for you to sort of play with in your mind. The child is playing passionately with his blocks and his caregiver tells him it's time to pack them up, but he doesn't listen. How might the caregiver respond? And if you think back in any of these scenarios that I just mentioned, staying past curfew or coming home late for dinner, how might the caregiver respond? So with the blocks, the caregiver may what? Demand that he put them away. They may come and take them away from them quite aggressively. They may threaten him with a timeout or punishment. And by the way, as a quick digression, this is not uncommon. When I do my social media content review, as many of you know that I do prior to recording each episode, I see this stuff that's suggested that you need to have these really firm boundaries. So if the child doesn't put away, I'll give them one command. And if the child doesn't listen, I will get up and I will take those blocks away from him. Now, this is one way, let's say, to respond, but it's not the way that I would recommend, because what I'm suggesting here is you have a child who's in a highly aroused state. And by the way, again, I'm just as way of reminder, not just the child. I said this could be the latent CAH child, this could be the teenager, or this can even be an adult that you know in your life. But the main point is that someone, in this case, the child is in a highly aroused state, and it's at the moment of reunion, returning, elated, excited, right? Excited to be out with friends, that they lose track of time. It's in this state of excited expectation that they return home. And this is the critical defining moment. An effective caregiver acts to maintain the child's arousal within a moderate range that's high enough to foster interaction with the child, teenager, yet not so intense, yelling at the kid, that's intense, not so intense as to cause distress or avoidance of this excited emotional state, as if they did something wrong to be so excited, to be caught up in the moment. If the caregiver demands he put away the blocks now, or comes and takes them away, or when the adolescent returns home late, they punish them, you're grounded, I'm taking away your phone, they threaten the child with timeout or some kind of punishment, this is, in my mind, a misattunement. Let me keep going. Let's picture the same response for the early adolescent, right? So let's say the child comes home late for dinner or stays out past curfew. The child has in their mind, this is not always conscious, so we're going just a little bit below the level of consciousness, but when they return home, they have in mind an anticipation of a shared affect state. In other words, they're so excited and they expect or hope that you too will be excited. But with any responses, any of the responses that I just detailed, the self then, the child, the teenager, your spouse, a loved one, unexpectedly experiences an affective misattunement. There's that word I just used a moment ago. And when there's a misattunement, this triggers a sudden shock-induced deflation in regulatory narcissistic affect. In other words, they begin to feel ashamed. Ashamed of how excited, ashamed about the anticipation, the expectation that you too would feel a similar way. So here again is the shame state that I detailed earlier with the man whose partner was not available when he was excited about text messaging throughout the weekend, or the woman looking forward to date night with her husband. Without realizing this, again, there are things that go on just below our level of consciousness. There's a misattunement. And when there's a misattunement, there could potentially be shame and humiliation, a narcissistic deflation, which then presents as depression. We're going back to where I started. As maturation proceeds, this is, again, why we see this later in life. We see this later in life because as maturation proceeds, this relational sequence that I just detailed and its associated shame affect is internalized. In other words, it's taken into one sense of self, which means what? What once took place in the child caregiver matrix is now performed intrapsychically. Basically, that's just a fancy word in my field of psychoanalysis to say inside oneself. So that doesn't, in other words, it doesn't really have to be occurring like this in reality. The perception, there's a perception of the absence or contradiction of some kind of matching admiration or excitement in the outside world, which constitutes the experience of shame. I'm a little worried that I may not have made that very clear. So let me just say that again. When they take this relational sort of matrix inside themselves through the act of internalization, it's something they carry around intrapsychically. And what that means is this doesn't actually have to happen like this exactly in later in life for this whole thing to get triggered. Okay, so now you may be saying, all right, I get this. I can see where it comes from, right? There's this misattunement, and then there's a feeling of shame and humiliation. And we internalize this and we carry it around. But can anything be done about this? In other words, in terms of how this happens today, are there any tools or techniques that I can use if I feel like I'm getting into this affective state of hypoarousal or withdrawal from people, from loved ones, from reality? And my response to that would be absolutely. If we reflect back on this discussion, I'm reminded of a valuable tool that can be incredibly empowering in moments like these. If you recall, we've already delved into the importance of self-awareness and introspection, particularly when faced with sudden shifts in a mood or a feeling, right? So by asking ourselves, like I did in those examples that I gave with these people that I see in terms of in my practice, if you can ask yourself questions like, when did this start? And where did this feeling come from? We can begin to unravel the underlying triggers and influences behind our emotional states. That's challenging, I understand, because oftentimes people wake up and they really believe this, that they just woke up feeling depressed today. But I promise you, if you could step back and really try to explore, you know, what happened the day before? And did I really just wake up depressed? Now, it is possible that you did, but that's where I started at the beginning of this episode, was I wanted to challenge all of you to consider that this may, remember I said there's more here than meets the eye. So was there a moment of misattunement or mismatch the day before leading to a sudden disappointment? And then this hypo-aroused state that I keep referring back to. Could it be a case of narcissistic deflation, where my expectations collided with reality in a shocking way? See, these are all just questions that I'm thinking out loud right now, but these are the things that I go over with people that I see in my practice. So yes, to answer your question, there are indeed tools and techniques at our disposal, and these are some of them. They're rooted now in the wisdom that we've explored together today. And these are tools and techniques that can help us navigate these challenging moments that we all encounter. So if you or someone you know is grappling with such difficulties, I'm here to offer support. If you're interested in acquiring more specific and individualized tools, feel free to contact me directly. My expertise lies in guiding individuals towards the development of a robust system for emotional self-regulation. And that's the key point here. We want a robust system where we can begin to auto-regulate, in other words, control our own emotions. That's the ultimate goal, right? Is to be in a position where we don't feel like our emotions are controlling us, but that we are controlling them, that we're in control of our emotions. So if you'd like to hear more about my approach, you have a few options. One, you can contact me directly. Two, be sure to subscribe to the Narcissism Decoder, where I always explore different facets of narcissism from different perspectives, which inevitably lead to different tools and techniques. Or finally, this is number three, you can subscribe to my video channel on YouTube, where I'm always pushing out slightly different content and concepts related to narcissism. And one more thing is, as always, I know this kind of stuff is very complex, and perhaps this is a very different way for you to think about depression. So if I said anything today that confused you, please feel free to reach out, share your questions, share your story. I would be delighted to hear from you. But unfortunately, we have to stop there for today. But as always, until next time, engage your mind. Bye for now. Disclaimer alert. The Narcissism Decoder podcast is provided for general information purposes only. The content presented in this podcast is not intended to diagnose, treat, or cure any psychological condition related to narcissism. The content on this podcast should not be considered a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. For specific advice pertaining to narcissism or any other psychological condition, you could reach me directly. I am an experienced mental health practitioner who is always taking on new patients. If you would just like a consultation, I can do that too.